it's personally very difficult for me to deal with this subject and to commemorate this weekend without being overcome by sadness, by tears. The reading always gets to me, the I Have a Dream speech, because it was a good dream. And it's a dream that I hold close to my heart, and sometimes I weep because that dream and its realization seems so far away. I remember so well, so clearly, the times when, during what we called the civil rights era, and it offends me that people talk about this being a post-civil rights era, because what could that possibly mean? Does it mean that civil rights have been accomplished? That we have leveled the playing field? That race doesn't matter? That race doesn't count? That poverty and racism and all of the various ways that we use from time to divide ourselves from each other, and all of those ways that divide us from each other make us less powerful and less potent within the political system, that those have been swept aside? That dream, the dream of Dr. Martin Luther King, has not been achieved, and the dream itself has been tarnished by the spinners who have taken it and grabbed it and made it about his life or made it about contentious issues of quotas and definitions of race. The fundamental thing that I remember so well from the civil rights era in its beginning, and by that I mean, and it's important to say this, white people believe that America was discovered in 1492. There are Native Americans who think that it might have been discovered somewhat earlier. When I'm talking about the civil rights era, I'm talking about the era when white people became acutely aware of the racism in our nation, the racism and the classism and the separations that were institutionalized sometimes within somebody's heart, sometimes within institutions such as churches and schools and government. And when white people came to the conclusion, some white people, that maybe this wasn't a good idea. Maybe the history of our nation has been that when our founding documents talked about all men being created equal, they meant all men, and they meant all white men, and they meant all white male property owners. But our history has been a journey, an evolution towards understanding that simple little word, men, to include black men and brown men and women of all races, and people who are not property owners, and people who are not Christian. And it has been an expansive understanding, but its expansion has not yet encompassed the dream that someday we would be judged, all of us of every color, ethnicity, and religion, gender, sexual preference, sexual identity, by the content of our character and not by the content of melanin within our skin. That dream seems so terribly far away. When I was young and in the civil rights movement, when I marched with my brothers and sisters who were black, who were white, who were Jewish and Protestant and Catholic, there were not at that time many Muslims. We marched with our arms around each other singing, "We Shall Overcome." Deep, deep in my heart, I know that we shall overcome someday. And we thought that someday would be someday soon. We thought that Martin Luther King had been to the mountaintop and had seen the promised land, and that though he would not live to enter it, we were close. we were close, and certainly 38 years after his tragic assassination and the loss of his vision and the loss of his dream, we have made a lot of progress in a lot of different ways. But in the words of Oscar Brown's work song, there is still so terrible long to go. And I believe that he saw the promised land. I believe that I know what it looks like. But I don't know, and society has not come to an agreement on how it is that we as a people, that means all of us, will get there together. Because there is no getting to the promised land alone. The promised land of equality and of justice, social justice, personal justice, a world where the schools offer equal opportunity across lines of race, class, and ethnicity. A world where the justice system offers equal protection under the law, and a black male is not 48 times more likely than a white male to do time for the same crime. A world where our justice system, as somebody pointed out, meaning just us, system is not designed to go from the womb and birth in a direct path to jail, where a staggering proportion of males of color are in our justice system. And it's not equal justice before the law. And it is not equal protection. We look around, we say, but look, we've made so much progress. Look at the most admired people in America, Colin Powell, Oprah Winfrey, white kids running around saying, well, a generation ago, I want to be Michael Jordan. I want to be a great star of music. They used to say Michael Jackson, but that's another story altogether. We have all of these heroes, and to some extent, it was unimaginable 50 years ago how far we have come in certain ways. But I think that we have a quality of respect towards people of color who have lots of money, that class trumps race in our social society. But when you have the twofer of no money, and as Muhammad Ali said, you don't have the complexion or the connection, you are in trouble in our educational system, in our justice system, and throughout our society. So much of de jure, legal segregation, has been ended. But what about de facto segregation? What about when you or I or any of us walks across a high school campus or even a college campus and you see the white kids and the Asian kids and the African American kids and the Hispanic kids? And they're not together except at the highest level of special interest. So that when you get into the theater department, when you get into some of the arts, you will find some integration and some social carryover. But we are still largely a nation that is fractured along lines of what we call race, class, and ethnicity. And it's a tragedy because all of these identifiers keep us apart. And by being kept apart, we are kept weak. There was a time when we could hold hands, brothers and sisters across those lines. There was a time when we could talk to each other and tell each other difficult truths about our hopes and our fears and our experiences. But as with so much of the American dialogue, the dialogue now is shouted across lines. And the sides are loud and trying to talk honestly about issues of race is, as every politician knows and as every preacher should know, It is a minefield when a wrong word can come back to haunt you, to stop a conversation. And with this amount of fear, we cannot therapize because we cannot talk about the issues of our anger, our hopes, and our fears. So instead, we point fingers. You know, it's all their fault. It's all Whitey's fault who created a system that was unfair. No, it's all their fault because they just won't get over it. Look at all the other groups that have done well. Just get over it. Those are fatal alternatives, and they are fatal to progress because it is not that simple at all. There are tremendous opportunities, and there are tremendous roadblocks to race relations. We still have so terrible long to go. Blame, oh, that's very easy to do, to point at people and their closed hearts or their fears or their angers. It's easy to diagnose and to explain, but how do we stop just explaining and begin transcending and connecting? I don't think with guilt. I don't think with anger, but with some sense of righteous participation, because everybody is part of the solution. We arrive at that promised land together, or nobody gets there. As the contradictions in American society between the wealthy, the wealthiest and the poorest become greater and greater, as they seem to line up along ethnic lines, this is the clearest and most present danger to American democracy. We cannot have two Americas, one ridiculously rich and one tragically poor, because America, if it means anything, it means bringing people together. Yes, we can look around the room and understand that, yes, it is still the most segregated hour in America, and as Unitarian Universalists, we can beat our breasts about that. But the truth is, there are social pressures on lots of people that keep us apart, that say, you know, if you hang out with white people, you're just trying to be white and you're forgetting your people. And there are all of these pressures in our society that say, you know, don't try to cross over that no man's land where we can really be together. It's hard. It's hard. I weep when I hear the words. I almost lost it when Margie talked about did the quote from Martin Luther King, that, and I've looked over and I've seen the promised land, and I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. The next day he was killed. I had to try to explain, as an American and as a white American, to an entire assembly of 3,500 North African Arab Muslims, boys and girls, what had happened, what race relations were about in America, why America seemed to be such a violent place. We talk and represented an American dream, but what they knew about America was that John F. Kennedy had been assassinated, that Martin Luther King had been assassinated, that shortly thereafter Robert F. Kennedy would be assassinated. And I'm trying to explain to them, in this is before RFK, what had happened and how that didn't really represent not only the best of who we are, but really who the majority of Americans of all colors are. And it was hard. It was hard to do. I had tears in my eyes because one of the instructors had taken Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech and had recited it to these students in French. And somehow hearing it in a foreign language, it was more literal, and I heard it in a different way. And in a way that really struck me, that someday the children of former slaves and former slave owners would be able to get together and be together and work for a more goodly nation together, to see the humanity in each other. And we have come a long way, but we still have so terrible long to go. We still have so terrible long to go with social policies that mean well, that were not designed to trap people, but sometimes did trap people in cycles of welfare and dependence. When I was in my Peace Corps training to go to North Africa, in the wisdom of the government, North Africa, Middle Africa, they put me in a housing project in Providence, Rhode Island. And the man of the house couldn't work above the table, or he would lose the housing for his wife and his three children. And he wanted to work, but he was trapped in a system that told him, if you work, you leave, and your family leaves. So he worked under the table. He cheated the system, because the system was a cheat on his future. This wasn't designed by evil people to trap black people in welfare. It was well-meaning, but it had unintended consequences. How do we deal with all the consequences, intended and unintended, of our social system? How do we go back to Martin Luther King's dream and revivify it so that it becomes, again, our dream, so that we own it and make it a part of our lives? There's a tremendous debate in both the black community and the white community about whether race counts and whether race matters. And I will tell you that from my viewpoint, I hold completely opposing and contradictory views within myself. And I don't have a problem with that. It just sounds like a problem. I am a radical non-believer in race. I think that race must not matter, that it's an artificial construct, that it's a 19th century anthropology, and it is a continuum, that we're all one race, and that is human. But it is foolish denial to assert that we have a level playing field that does not judge people by what we call race. There's no definition that we have of handsome or ugly, but we make these distinctions. There shouldn't be a legal definition of race, but we make the distinctions, and we have to deal with the fact that race doesn't have to be real for racism to be a cruel and toxic fact of our society. And so some people say, look, we shouldn't count race in order to equalize the playing field, because counting race to end racism is like killing for peace. Well, I understand the metaphor, but we also have to deal with the reality that we do make decisions about people. Everybody in the world profiles. Every adult profiles the people that come to their door, the people that are going to date their sons and daughters. We all make judgments about people, sometimes at the very most shallow and surface means of racial identity. We need to get past that as a society. We need to work for a society that does not allow for the extremes of wealth, for the inequality of opportunity in education, that works actively to put people together, building bridges of dialogue, real dialogue, not just scoring points and comparing wounds, but real dialogue that helps us move a step towards that promised land. We sang the hymn, Precious Lord, Take My Hand. Some of you who are not familiar with Unitarian Universalist traditions, or actually some of you who are familiar with Unitarian Universalist traditions, might have wondered about Precious Lord. That sounds awful theological. It sounds, and Lord sounds sexist and gender specific, not to mention hierarchical. Those are the three Trinitarian sins against Unitarianism. But listen to what it means. I am weary. Take my hand. How can we not feel weary when we look at how far we have gone, how hard it has been, and how terrible long we have yet to go? How can we not feel discouraged when all kinds of programs are instituted and tax cuts are put in place in our society and education and health and funds to fight poverty are taken out of the budget? How can you not just say, okay, I'm going to cocoon. I'm going to just go back to my home. I'm going to turn off the radio and the television, cancel my subscription to the paper, and make it all go away. I don't know how the ostrich has survived, but it's only survived on one continent. Sticking your head in the ground is a very vulnerable position for the rest of you. And the fact is, we need our heads up. We need our eyes open. We need our hearts and our ears open. And we need to be able to make the connection from eye to heart to hand to find those days when we can march again and talk again and sing again and cry again and hope again and dream again, to give us the energy to take those steps that will bring us closer to that day. Now, I share with Dr. King a very important vision and, I believe, truth. Racism will be beaten in America within the lifetime of our grandchildren. Race will not matter, because we're going to keep marrying each other and interbreeding, and we're going to have a wonderful melange of people, and it will be impossible. The idea of going from quadroons to octoroons, at some point we're just going to have to drop that stuff and understand that we're people. But towards the end of his life, Dr. King moved his eyes from simply the struggle of black people to the struggle about poverty and about justice and social justice for all. And he's moved, and that's where ultimately the battle for equality will be won or lost. I am not as sanguine that we will end discrimination based on class. I do believe that race is doomed as a concept, but class is not. And so that it is in the narrowest and the broadest sense that Dr. King's dream is both the dream of the I Have a Dream speech and his dream of social justice as he turned north and went to Chicago to try to bring real justice for all. There are more people living in poverty who are white than black. There are more births out of wedlock, although the percentage is higher in the black community than white, but there are more people living in urban poverty, in rural poverty. Class, equality, is where the efforts of the civil rights movement, and this is not the post-civil rights era, this is the civil rights era. We can only arrive at the promised land if we make a pact to arrive together, if we have the understanding that when our sisters and brothers are in chains and are kept out of good schools and out of great institutions of learning and of research, that all of us are diminished. Hatred diminishes the hater and the hated. It is a wound to the soul of the object of hate, and it is poison to the soul of the people who hate. When Martin Luther King talked about love being the answer, that wasn't a simple hippy-dippy, let's love one another. That was something of profound meaning within his church and within his soul, of agape, of the acceptance of the humanity, the strong points, the weak points, of all human beings, and to understand that we are not separated, we must not be separated by the thin illusions that we use to say, in this season there's a Serb, in this season there's a Croat, in this season there is a Black, there is an Hispanic. We are people. We are people who need so much to be able to see the humanity in each other, to be able to see the humanity in the adversary and not make the adversary into the enemy. We can have profound disagreements. We can yell and shout and scream with love and with respect. I suspect most people who lived in homes shouted once in a while, yelled, maybe even slammed doors, but that's not an absence of love. We have to trust the love within us in order to create the connections that let us live a dream, that let us get a step closer to where all people are judged by what we do, by the content of our character as it is exemplified in our lives, and not by how fine the silk is in the clothing, how light the complexion is, how sparkling the teeth are, and how much money is in the bank account. People of all colors, of all races, of all economic strata share this planet and share the same basic humanity. The dream is revivified when we open up our eyes and our hearts to see the humanity in every one of us.